This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity. Enjoy the show.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Prominent Democrats on both sides of the Connecticut River came out for Hillary Clinton this week. From New Hampshire, U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen gave her endorsement, while from Vermont, Governor Peter Shumlin and former Governor Howard Dean did as well. Speaking in Keene, Dean highlighted Clinton's knowledge of foreign policy.
She has enormous experience in dealing with all the people who are not any fun to deal with around the world, like Vladimir Putin and the Ayatollahs. And I think Hillary would be a very strong leader in that regard.
Also this week, Northern Pass officials continued their effort to gain approval for the hydropower project with a public meeting in Concord. And like elsewhere, some capital city residents called for the lines in their backyards to be buried. But Eversource Energy President Bill Quinlan said, once again, that putting the whole thing underground would be too expensive.
We continue to focus on the need for balance. I mean, we can build a project that has no scenic impact or little scenic impact and is unaffordable.
And as more police departments move toward use of body cameras, debate is brewing over who gets to see that footage. This has come up in the case of a Canterbury man killed by police in a confrontation in Haverhill. Gilles Bissonnette of the New Hampshire ACLU argued this week that the video should be released.
The public has a right to know how and when law enforcement used lethal force when confronting individuals who potentially are suffering from serious mental illness, as may be the case here.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for this week are Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, welcome.
Morning, Laura.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, gentlemen, I wanted to start briefly with all the controversy, concern over medical marijuana dispensaries and cultivation centers. This program is starting to roll out, but slowly, Dean Spiliotis. What's the big picture on this?
Well, the process is moving along slowly, but apparently surely. You remember this was enacted in 2013, and they had talked about a two-year phase-in. So we're already kind of at the outer limit of that. They divided the state up into these four geographical zones for the dispensaries. Three of the four geographical zones, there's been an announcement of who the vendor is, where it's going to be located. So there's going to be one in Merrimack, one in Lebanon, one in the Plymouth area, and then the final one, which is sort of the eastern part of the state, Stratford, I think Belknap and Rockingham. Perhaps they're trying to they haven't announced yet where that's going to be. But, you know, the bigger criticism of this has been that it's not moving as quickly as it should. And this is one of the concerns. If you remember back when the law was passed, Governor Hassan did not want a homegrown option. A number of supporters had said that you needed a homegrown option to fill the gap that was going to be inevitable in phasing this in. So there has been some criticism that the process is not moving as quickly as it should, but there have been a number of public hearings around the state, and we're sort of in the middle of the permitting process right now.
And when you say they, you mean DHHS, right?
State Department of Health and Services is – They sort of oversee the process, but there are also permitting and zoning issues for each of the different localities where these dispensaries and the production facilities are going to be placed.
Cultivation centers.
Yes.
Okay,
yeah,
Jeff.
Well, and actually, a little wrench in the works is that there's been at least one of the losing bidders in this has complained about the regulatory process that the DHHS has used. He says they're moving the goalposts, that the appeals process was – he questioned the appeals process, and in the articles I've read, it sounds like he may be looking at some kind of legal action, which would really muddy the waters here. And something else that's really interesting to me is that this whole background, we have a story in the paper coming out actually today about even when they get these dispensaries open, there's all kinds of federal there's a federal court ruling, there's federal the IRS, and also the banking industry, banks just don't want to do business with these things. So once these companies open,
because marijuana is still a federally illegal drug.
Yeah, it's a controlled substance. So these people, once they open, it's how they stay in business or how they operate as a business is really kind of interesting.
You know what I would like to ask you about, Jeff, or you, Dean, is when the law was first being debated, I remember people saying, communities don't have to have these dispensaries if they're uncomfortable, if they don't want them, if it doesn't just fit with what they want. Has that turned out to be the case, Jeff?
Well,
communities can say no?
Yeah, well, it's not necessarily. It doesn't seem like they've, they've people come out in force in some of the towns, and other towns they're welcoming them. I found it kind of interesting that I think in Peterborough they welcome the growth center pretty easily, but that's the major concern, is that the process is kind of moving along. It's shifting. Yeah. The rules and how they're enforced and interpreted.
Yeah, there was also a recent hearing about a cultivation center in Rochester and a big mill building in the city, and they said there was a big turnout, but not a lot of pushback on the location. My sense is, and it's my sense of some of the other locations as well, they're in places that are kind of in the vicinity to serve a large geographical population, but sort of placed with kind of the communities in mind. So that hasn't been a huge issue. The bigger issue has been kind of the lack of progress and getting these things up and running.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point. I mean, it's been years now. And I mean, I guess you get one point you say it's careful, but another point you say, what the heck's going on here?
And we have a very sort of tightly, narrowly defined group of illnesses that qualify. These are people who are either gravely ill or very seriously chronically ill. And this was the concern going in. If it takes 3-4 years, these people are suffering. And that's
the problem. And they were suffering 3 or 4 years ago, the same people. And there's been waiting this whole time. So it's interesting. I mean, they're trying to be careful in the process. There are issues involved with the localities. There are issues involved with, but certainly you think first and foremost would be the patients themselves, the people who actually they've passed this law for to help these people through their pain and other issues that they face.
All right. Well, this is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. And again, you can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And gentlemen, let's turn to another story that has implications not just in New Hampshire, but elsewhere. This concerns the use of police body camera footage. Who should have access to it and who should not? With us now is Jeremy Blackman. He's been covering this issue for the Concord Monitor. Jeremy, thank you for taking time out.
Thanks for having me.
Well, give us the basics of this story, please, Jeremy. Who's involved? What happened?
So this involves a shooting from early July. It was on July 6th in Bath, and there were two Haverhill police officers who found a 42-year-old Canterbury man, Hagen S.D. Lennon, staggering along Route 302 with a knife in his hand and an apparent chest wound. And they told him to drop the weapon. He refused, and they tried to use a taser on him, but have said that he was too far away for it to be effective. And he eventually charged at one of the officers with the knife drawn, and they opened fire. And he died on the spot, and his mother's attorney has been very critical of the shooting, which was deemed justified by the Attorney General's office, and they have said they plan to sue. Now, the AG's office had planned to release the videos from the two officers' body cameras. They were activated during the encounter, and they had planned to release those in early August, but the family and officers were given a chance to view it first, and they have seen those, and his ex-wife has objected to the release of the videos, saying that they are just totally graphic and would invade the privacy of especially his young surviving children. And that is what has brought us to court. Several media outlets have petitioned for the release of these videos.
So the family does not want these released. Privacy issues, obviously the moment of death is, a sacred moment. I don't want, not sacred, but you know what I'm trying to say. It's a private moment.
It's not a routine traffic stop.
Yeah, exactly. So understandable there. So who wants this video released? You said news organizations.
Well, we do, for one.
Yeah.
I'm not me, but our company, Newspapers of New Hampshire, which includes the Concord Monitor and Valley News, WMUR, the Union Leader, and now the ACLU has joined the push for disclosure. And the people who are pushing for this are, you know, they're arguing that police officers are given an incredible authority to take a person's life if there is a safety issue involved, and that there should be a check on that, or at least a way for the public to weigh in on what their behavior or what their actions, whether they were in fact justified. And that is, you know, arguably the reason for these body cameras existing.
So the Attorney General, correct me if I'm wrong, Jeremy, says it's okay to release these?
Yeah, actually, the town of Haverhill, the police department there, and the Attorney General's office have both said they would not oppose a release, though the AG's office has said that they would like to redact portions, roughly a four-minute section right after the shooting occurs, which they claim is the really graphic part and is not germane to the actual vetting of what took place.
So how is this going to be resolved, Jeremy?
Well, a judge here in Concord, Judge Favre, has said he will issue a ruling any day now. The deadline for people to submit petitions on, you know, submit their arguments for why it should be or shouldn't be released was Tuesday. So we are waiting a decision now, and that could presumably be appealed. Now, Judge Favre has, you know, has a system that he has said he will be using to weigh the release of this, which is under the state's right to know law. There is a three-pronged approach, which is weighing the privacy interests of the family, weighing the public interests, and then balancing those two and deciding what is, you know, more a prevalent interest.
Wow, that's a lot to weigh, though, Jeremy. Again, you know, someone died here, and the family has their concerns, but you can also see that, you know, police body cameras are supposedly a tool to help us keep track of what our public officers are doing.
Well, exactly. And this is, you know, not specific to New Hampshire. And what the ACLU mentioned this week, which I thought was interesting, was that this appears to be the first type of case of this nature that has come before court anywhere in the U.S. So it's really going to be or could be a precedent setter. And of course, different states have different right-to-know laws, but presumably they could be looking to us to see how we act on this and go forward. But I don't imagine the decision here will be the last we'll hear of it.
All right. Well, Jeremy, thank you very much for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Laura. Bye.
That's Jeremy Blackman. He's covering again this issue for the Concord Monitor. Coming up, a presidential update. Paul Steinhauser from NH1 will join us. Lots of presidential news to catch up on. More in just a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and we're going to turn now to presidential politics. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests this week are Jeff Feingold and Dean Spiliotis. And with us now for more news from the presidential campaign trail is Paul Steinhauser, political director with NH1 News. And Paul, thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Laura. Thank you.
So who are you following around this week, Paul?
It was a busy week. We had Ted Cruz back in the state for the first time in, can you believe this, almost 2 months.
Really? Wow.
But it doesn't seem to be hurting him. He had pretty good crowds here, pretty good energy, and his poll numbers in New Hampshire, actually, for somebody who's barely been here and has an extremely small staff, his poll numbers here are pretty good. He has been riding the coattails, I guess you could say, of Donald Trump. Very friendly with Trump. They're teaming up next week in Washington for a rally to go against the Iran nuclear deal. And he has said nothing but good things about Trump. His strategy, he hopes that Trump's bringing all these new eyeballs into the party, and they're also going to see him and like what he has to say, because he has a very similar anti-Washington message that Donald Trump has.
Wait a minute. Ted Cruz and Donald Trump teaming up? Aren't they rivals for the nomination?
They are rivals for the nomination. There's 17 of them all together. Hard to keep track. But they will be teaming up in Washington next week for this rally to go to oppose the the deal.
Now, why would Dean Spiliotis, Ted Cruz, not come to New Hampshire, avoid New Hampshire for 2 months? I'm struck by that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the argument traditionally has been that he's kind of not the best fit ideologically for the electorate of New Hampshire, that he's more likely to do well in places like Iowa or South Carolina, where you have a much larger percentage of social and religious conservatives in the party base than you would in New Hampshire. So, you know, the argument had been that he's not a particularly good ideological fit for the state. And I think that's one reason why we haven't seen him. On the other hand, as we were just talking about, there is this thinking out there, and Cruz is by no means the only candidate who believes this, that if at some point Donald Trump finally fizzles out or implodes or what have you, and you know, who knows if and when that's going to happen now, the thinking is that, you know, he's sort of well-positioned to take over the kind of Tea Party support for Trump. There are a lot of conservatives in the electorate who, even though they understand that Trump is not a traditional conservative, they just like him for a variety of reasons. And the thinking is if Trump gets out, a lot of that support would then go to Cruz. But, you know, there are others like, you know, Marco Rubio and others who think, well, no, maybe the support will come to them. So I think that's kind of – he is sort of around Trump and maybe around New Hampshire a little bit as a result of that.
Well, it's interesting. With so many candidates, as Paul said, you almost see people having to adopt new and different strategies to manage themselves in this giant field. Go ahead,
absolutely.
Jeff.
Absolutely. I think it's interesting this year. I mean, obviously, it's like, as Paul said, there were 17 Republican candidates. But I haven't – something I hadn't noticed before is there's really a large number of these 17 are just not avoiding New Hampshire. Like Ted Cruz is not avoiding New Hampshire, but New Hampshire is not primarily on their list of places to go. There's Ted Cruz. There's Mike Huckabee. Ben Carson hasn't been here very often. Rick Santorum, he hasn't been around very often. And there are others who just kind of –
Rick Perry.
He won't be here at all coming up. I don't think about that count. Maybe that's number – maybe should I say 16 candidates at this point.
James Gilmore.
He's still in.
Yeah, but there are others
who are just not
avoiding New Hampshire, but New Hampshire is not a key part of their strategy. They're staying in Iowa. They're going to South Carolina.
I think we expected that would happen.
But what I'm saying is because of such a large number of such a large number of candidates, there's even more this time around who are just not – New Hampshire is not part of their strategy. And, you know, we'll see what happens because for others, you know, Hampshire's extremely important. You know, John Kasich is, you know, and Jeb Bush and many others who are
Chris
just
Christie.
Chris Christie, yeah, who, you know, they're just keying in on New Hampshire.
Sure, that's interesting, and that's what you would expect, right? With social conservatives migrating to places like South Carolina. Update us on Rick Perry, there, Paul. Some news surrounding the Rick Perry campaign.
Yeah, he had a tough. We haven't seen Rick Perry up here since the forum back at the beginning of August that the union leader did, and we haven't seen him. He was up here a lot earlier in the year. To his credit, he was really campaigning here more than we even expected. His campaign has had some tough financial times. The fundraising is not what they envisioned it would be. He's had to shed staff in Iowa, but here he's shed all of his staff now. His top field director was just left the campaign and went to John Kasich. And senior advisor, a guy called Mike Dennehy, well known up here. He helped steer McCain's two victories in 2000 and 2008 up here. He is now no longer on the payroll either. So Rick Perry's campaign here in New Hampshire is basically zero now. He still has a campaign. He's still campaigning in Iowa. His super PACs actually still have money. His campaign himself, though, the actual, you know, his is getting pretty low on funds.
Okay, that's interesting. So what does that mean, Dean Spiliotis?
It sounds like his, you know, obviously it's for him to decide, but it sounds like his campaign is essentially over because he's not doing particularly well anywhere else. And it seems like the next debate coming up in a little over a week on CNN, he probably won't be on the main stage again, and that's problematic.
Pretty safe bet.
Yeah, I mean, he just never bounced back from that problematic run the last time around, and he was one of the first people here after the 2014 midterm election. I mean, he started early. He talked about how he was sort of schooling himself on the issues. He talked about problems he had had with an injury and some medication.
The glasses.
You know, to reassure people he was coming back stronger this time. It just hasn't happened.
Well, and I do have a couple questions about Democrats, too. But go ahead, Jeff.
You know, what they're talking about with the super PAC, he does have a, you know, pretty sizable super PAC. And it raises the question, what happens when there's a super PAC without a candidate? What happens to all that money? I mean,
there's plenty of other choices for that super PAC, I guess, right?
I mean, it'd be interesting because he obviously will have some kind of influence on the race, whether he's in it or not.
A couple more questions on the Republican side. And then there was some news in New Hampshire on the Democratic side. Paul Steinhauser, Carly Fiorina, and Ben Carson said to be doing well in Iowa. What about New Hampshire?
doing okay here. Not as strong as in Iowa. Carson's numbers in Iowa are astronomical now, and nationally he's on the rise. He was just here in New Hampshire about 2 weeks ago. I had a chance to speak to him. He was at the Puritan Backroom, among other places. I like Ben Carson because he doesn't look or sound like any other candidate, and I'm not talking about his skin color. I'm just talking about his demeanor. He is the anti-candidate. This guy is 10 times smarter than any of the other candidates. He's a brain surgeon, but he's just so different than the rest of them. His upbringing is so much different than the rest of them, and that's why he stands out. He is generating some interest. Carly Fiorina, her campaign as well, another one of those small campaigns that is now on the rise. Another one, though, that is interesting. And you guys had a very good report on NHPR earlier this morning about this. Her campaign really leaving her super PAC to do a lot of the work that traditionally a campaign would do. It's coming this close to breaking the law, but it's not breaking the law, and it's darn effective.
Well, that is interesting because you use those words, her super PAC. We're not even really supposed to say that, right? It's like a super PAC who happens to support Carly Fiorina. That's how we used to talk about
that's
it.
That's how you – you know, let's be honest. And, you know, these super PACs are run by advisors that used to be with the candidate up until they became a candidate. You're not breaking the law, but you're getting it around it very conveniently.
John Kasich also making waves here in New Hampshire, had a strong debate performance about a month ago, Dean, and continues to gain strength.
He's been very active here. He's doing a number of town halls. He's going to be back here again in the coming week. He is someone who has benefited tremendously from the back and forth between Donald Trump and Jeb Bush. For a variety of reasons, Trump has kind of focused on Bush and has sort of sought to really knock him back on his heels. And there's been this real intense back and forth between the two campaigns. The thinking has always been that Kasich would be sort of an establishment alternative to Bush. And so he has been able to build his organization in the state in relative peace and quiet. He's decided to kind of avoid Trump. It's worked well for him at the moment. And so he is someone who is polling quite well here. Iowa will be a different set of challenges for him. But nonetheless, he's kind of like Chris Christie and a few others. He's kind of staked his run on building a base here, and he seems to be going about that pretty effectively.
You know, actually, if you look at him going around the state, he does kind of remind you of the classic New Hampshire Republican primary candidate who actually can attract independent voters, you know, and I'm thinking of John McCain in particular. And, this is a very unusual cycle in this campaign because of Donald Trump in it. If Trump weren't in it, I think that would the Kasich would be even stronger. I think because he would be the alternative to Bush. Now he's like standing out now as almost like the alternative to Trump for some people, or Ben Carson in other cases. But he's really starting to get some traction in New Hampshire because he has that energy. He's kind of iconoclastic. He has some views that don't go along the mainstream of the Republican Party, which makes him an interesting candidate.
Paul?
I asked him, I talked to him the other day when he was up in Hopkinton at New England College, or at Henniker. I said, why are you not taking on Donald Trump like so many of your rivals? He said, listen, if I'm talking about somebody else, I'm not talking about me and what I want to do for the country. And he goes, I'm like that golfer who pays attention to his score but really isn't looking at what what the other guys or ladies are doing. So he is very focused right now on his message, and it is resonating up here. But you're right. He has some stances on issues when it comes to Medicaid expansion, when it comes to
Common Core.
There's a bunch of issues that could hurt him with conservatives. But right now, with 17 people in the race, you don't have to worry about that. If he's going for the establishment moderate lane, he's doing pretty well right now in that lane.
Okay, so let's talk about Jeb Bush then. Speaking of establishment moderate, that was the thinking, Paul, going into this race, that Jeb Bush would represent that. How is Jeb Bush playing here in the Granite State?
His crowds are still, they're respectable. I saw him yesterday in Hampton. His crowds are doing it's not like they're withering at all. He's got a pretty strong campaign up here. He's still got a lot of supporters. He's getting much feistier and more aggressive on the campaign trail. We've noticed that the last two trips up here, he's pushing back against Donald Trump. He did not want to do that. This is not the campaign he wants to be running right now, but he has to. And he's been pushing back pretty effectively, even putting out a web video the other day, which got a lot of play both here and nationally, which showed all of Trump's past interviews where he was in favor of universal health care and where he was loving Hillary Clinton. So he's trying to say Trump is not the real conservative. I am. But again, this is not where he thought he would be in September of 2015. But he says, I'm in this for the long haul. And,
well,
he's got money, and his super PAC's got a lot of money.
Well, one more question about another candidate. We talked about those who really aren't playing here in New Hampshire, some of those more religious or socially based conservatives who haven't paid as many visits, and then the folks who've been up here a lot. Dean Spiliotis, Rand Paul, the more libertarian-oriented candidate, when this campaign started, a lot of people thought he'd be a great fit for New Hampshire.
Yeah, and I think it's something I've thought about a lot, and I think, you know, part of what's happened for him is, you know, when he had that tremendous visibility a year ago or so on the National Security Agency wiretapping and a lot of the other kind of security issues, he sort of had the platform up here to himself. He's one of the few people who really seemed to have presidential ambitions, and I think he benefited both from the high visibility of that issue, which I think has receded a little bit, and also the fact that it wasn't a crowded field. And so for a variety of reasons now, we had expected him to kind of build on his father Ron Paul's support here in the state. He had that sort of rough time around the first presidential debate with Donald Trump and others, and he hasn't really bounced back for that. I think he's just sort of – he's having trouble figuring out kind of what the next thing that's going to give him traction is after the NSA stuff. I mean, that's still out there, but it's not sort of top of mind enough anymore to really drive him to the front of the conversation. I think he's been struggling, but there's still – he does still have a good core group of support. But it's been rough, no doubt about it.
Yeah, hard to figure out for these candidates, all of them, where you fit in such a big field. Go ahead, Jeff.
It also shows that, you know, he's not his father. So his father had a certain kind of a base that just is not. He has some of it, but he hasn't inherited his father's base, really, if you look in New Hampshire at least, which is really interesting because most of us thought, oh, yeah, he'll just have his father's and it'll move up and get his father's
Paul
and build
on
it.
Yeah, Ron Paul was very
popular here. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Still is.
Go ahead, Paul.
To Dean's point, it was a good one. He is definitely getting overshadowed. He put out a web video, his campaign, doing the same thing that Bush did, showing old Donald Trump clips about how liberal he was and how he was a Democrat. He did that about 3 weeks before Jeb Bush. Didn't get much traction. Jeb Bush does it. Everybody's talking about it. Rand Paul's become the forgotten candidate in many ways. But again, we're still not to Labor Day. So you could take everything that's happened up until now, not throw it out, but just say that was preseason. Starting Monday or starting now, it gets real.
Right. That's right.
Just
Labor
like the
Day.
NFL, the season starts this week.
Exactly.
Which we are going to talk about later in the hour. I also want to remind everyone that you can join us. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange. And boy, there's been a lot to catch up on the presidential front and elsewhere in Granite State News. Join us with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Dean Spiliotis is here, along with Jeff Feingold and Paul Steinhauser. And we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Gentlemen, not as many Democrats running, but still half a dozen candidates or so. And Paul, Hillary Clinton got some support from Vermont this week.
Oh, with Howard Dean, are we talking about?
Howard Dean and Peter Shumlin.
And Peter Shumlin, yeah, both stumping for her. No surprise, they've both been supporters of her for quite some time. But it is interesting, you know, of course, with Bernie Sanders topping Hillary Clinton in the last two polls here in New Hampshire, it is interesting that they're bringing the Vermont surrogates down to New Hampshire. They're feeling the heat. They admit it. I talked to John Podesta. He is the campaign chairman for the Clinton campaign. He was up in New Hampshire the other day for the first time this cycle. So another piece of evidence that they're really pulling out all the stops. And he admitted that, Sanders is doing well, but they're sticking with their game plan. Even if I said, what if Vice President Joe Biden jumps in? He goes, we're sticking with our game plan. He also admitted that the email controversy has been a big distraction, but it's not preventing, he says, Hillary Clinton from going out there and talking about the issues that people want to hear.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jeff.
Also, for New Hampshire, from the New Hampshire's perspective, Senator Shaheen is endorsing her, which is not a surprise to anybody, but that's going to be coming out.
It's a big endorsement.
Absolutely.
But the timing. The timing is
exactly
interesting. That's
exactly
what everybody's talking about.
Yeah.
Why now?
Exactly. And it seems like there's a lot of people lining up behind her. We've had a lot of surrogates coming into the state to endorse her. And they're pulling out a lot of the stops that you think that they might have held a little bit later on. But they're obviously trying to get some traction because Bernie Sanders will be here Labor Day, and we'll see what kind of crowds he has. And he has
Bernie Sanders is going to be here on Labor Day.
Yes.
Okay.
And it'll be interesting to see what he draws again, because that's that's a big day for him, Labor Day, you know. So
he's got a jam-packed schedule that day, morning till night, all over the state, ending up right here in Concord, actually.
Yeah, with his support for unions and a higher minimum wage and so forth. So we should talk also about Senator Sanders and how he's doing here in New Hampshire. Dean, your thoughts?
He's doing well. I mean, he's, as we've seen both here and in Iowa, he's getting a lot of traction. He's drawing big crowds. You know, I think getting sort of relating it to Hillary Clinton, I think they still believe. I mean, they are making some adjustments, as Jeff said. I think they still believe that they can win this sort of with the long game, just by sheer force of kind of organization and sort of longer term support and money. But there's no doubt about it. Bernie Sanders has tapped into this sort of kind of restive base of the progressive base of the party, who feel like, you know, President Obama didn't fulfill all of his promises. And so he's been continuing to talk extensively about job security and wage inequality and all that kind of stuff. Been getting a little bit of pressure from the media for not talking enough about foreign policy. I saw one interview with him over the weekend where one of the national interviewers pointed out that there was nothing on his website about foreign policy. And then he looked a little bit surprised and said, well, we'll be addressing that shortly. So I think they are pressing him a little bit more now on foreign policy. But there's no doubt about it. He's doing well. I think the Clinton folks think they can weather this. But it also has been problematic for these other candidates like Martin O'Malley, who's been around a lot, Lincoln Chafee, Jim Webb, who is running, although we haven't really seen him here more than once or twice. So, it's quite a head-to-head matchup.
Sure. Well, and Paul, we do need to finish talking about the Democrats with a question about Joe Biden. Still says he doesn't know if he's going to run for president.
Yeah. In fact, last night, the latest, he was at an event in Atlanta, and he was asked in Q&A, and he said, unless I can go to my party and the American people and say that I'm able to devote my whole heart and my whole soul to this endeavor, it would not be appropriate to run. So he's still struggling, of course, with the loss of his eldest son, Beau Biden, who died earlier this year. So that is still really eating at him, obviously. He is also Biden, I guess you could say, is biding his time in a way. I think part of the strategy for his advisors is, you know, they're waiting for Hillary Clinton to crumble a little bit more. She's crumbled a lot. Her polls have receded. They want to be the candidate to come in there and rescue the party, rescue the Democratic establishment. But, you know, if Hillary Clinton doesn't crumble, where's Joe Biden's avenue? Up here, though, I broke the story earlier this week, the Draft Biden, which is this independent super PAC that's trying to lay the groundwork, much like Ready for Hillary did for Hillary Clinton. They added a top person up here, a state rep who has been a big supporter of him. So we'll see.
Okay. Very interesting. Paul Steinhauser, thank you for helping us out. We always appreciate it.
Always great to join you guys. Thank you so much.
That's Paul Steinhauser again, political director for NH1 News. When we come back, vigils against heroin around the Granite State. And we'll look a little bit more about the state's sex offender laws. Some say they may need to be revised. Coming up, this is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're catching up on some of the top Granite State headlines this week. You can join us 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests for the roundup this week are Jeff Feingold with New Hampshire Business Review and Dean Spiliotis, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And we're joined now by NHPR's Paige Sutherland. She covered the recent conclusion of a high-profile rape trial of a St. Paul school graduate and now the fallout from that concerning New Hampshire's sex offender laws. Paige, thank you for being here.
No, thanks for having me, Laura.
So just briefly remind us, please, Paige, what the verdict was in this case.
Yeah, so Owen LaBrie was convicted of four misdemeanor charges and one felony charge. The four misdemeanor charges involve three statutory rape charges, which means he was a senior at the time, she was a freshman, she was 15, and in New Hampshire, you can't consent unless you're at least 16 or older. And then the other misdemeanor charge is the endanger the welfare of a child. The big charge here was the felony charge, which going into trial we didn't think was a big charge, but it was actually the most serious charge that he was convicted of, which is the illegal use of a computer. It means he used a computer to lure in a minor to have sex with her. And then he was acquitted of the most serious charge, which is the felony rape charge, which means that he forced himself upon her. And so when it comes to that charge, that would have held up to 20 years in prison. And so looking at that verdict, what happened is the jury doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't believe the victim. So basically, it could mean that the state just didn't have a strong enough case that they could acquit him with on beyond a reasonable doubt that he forced himself upon her.
And just to clarify, most people probably know this, but just to clarify, a misdemeanor obviously is bad. A felony is worse. It follows you around forever, and the punishment is much more severe.
Yeah, so when it comes to a misdemeanor, it's about a year of prison time for each charge, and you have to be on the sex registry. And that would be only for 10 years, but when it comes to a felony, it's life. It's lifetime that you have to be on that.
On the registry, on the sex offender registry. So, Paige, from what I understand, now people are looking again at some of these tough sex offender laws. What aspects in particular are people looking at?
So when it comes to the illegal computer use, that was the only felony charge that he was convicted of. And so he would have to be on the registry, like I said, for life. And so that is the charge that his attorney came out and said right after the verdict that he is going to appeal within 30 days because that statute was more designed for predators, people who are older and trying to lure in children by pretending they were younger. It wasn't meant for teenagers who were talking on Facebook and just trying to meet up. So he thinks that although the jury applied the statute, it wasn't meant for someone like Olin LeBrie.
That's interesting. So when this law was crafted, they were thinking about, you know, older predators who, you know, go into gaming areas where kids play and try and lure kids. This is different. This is how teens communicate.
Exactly.
Really.
Exactly.
Facebook and so forth. Who besides LeBrie's attorney, Paige, is saying maybe these laws need another look?
So some legal experts are saying that it just shouldn't apply to Olin LeBrie. He's 19 years old, and with this brand on him, being on the registry will just mark him forever. I mean, certain jobs he can't apply for, certain areas he can't live in, he's going to have his name out there forever. And again, he's 19 years old. So they just think that this is too harsh of a punishment. And so they also, the state senator who heads the Judiciary Committee for New Hampshire, says that, you know, this law has been on the books for some years and she's going to maybe give it a second look.
Is that feeling universal, Paige, or are there people who, again, who've been watching, commenting, observing, who feel like, look, these laws are appropriate, justice was served?
Yeah, so victims' rights advocates have come out and said, you know, LeBrie willingly and knowingly used his computer to take advantage of a younger girl who is vulnerable and convinced her to have sex with him. And so they think the law was applied right because that's what he did. He knowingly went on his Facebook and tried to get her to meet up with him.
All right. Well, I have a feeling we'll be talking about this again. Thank you very much, Paige.
No.
We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
NHPR's Paige Sutherland, again, covering the fallout from a rape trial concerning a St. Paul's student. You can join us. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Jeff Feingold, Dean Spilios, a couple other major stories that we do need to catch up on. Jeff, to you, the Northern Pass update. The debate returns to central New Hampshire. What's going on?
Well, what we go back a couple of weeks, and Eversource, Eversource and the people who are behind Northern Pass basically said that they want to build many more miles underground. And that seemed to be
about a third of the total project.
Yes, about a third of the project, and it's going to be cost. They say it'll cost so much more. And what they want to do is basically, no pun intended, head off at the pass the opposition, which has been calling for more burial,
burial,
yes,
right?
But now the opposition says no, we want it all buried, not just these 50 something miles, whatever. They want the whole thing buried. And that's basically it's almost like a poker game at this point where they keep raising, you know, this I'll see you 50 miles and we want 180, whatever. And then what's going on now is that we've had hearings where people really very vocally are saying, no, we do not want this thing unless it's completely buried. And Eversource, Bill Quinlan, the president of New Hampshire, is basically saying, you know, this is it. This is what we're doing. And you know we're going to try our best to, you know, we've taken into consideration all, you know, your concerns about the landscape and all that stuff, and this is the plan we have. And it's interesting now because what's the next step? Because Eversource is going to put their application in and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, that's the big question, isn't it? What's the next step? And it's
Absolutely.
Been such a long process.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, for people who lived through it, it kind of has is reminiscent of the Seabrook battle because you know it just kept. You know, the opponents were just saying no, 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 no.
Although eventually Seabrook was built.
Well, half of Seabrook was built, if you remember. There's still a monument to what happened because Seabrook 2 was never built,
That's
never
right.
finished. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so Dean, yeah. there's also a for a long time there's been sort of a Northern New Hampshire versus Southern yeah. New Hampshire dynamic, but then here's Concord sort of yeah. even though on the map it seems more Southern New Hampshire, it's more a Central New Hampshire dynamic. How do you see that?
It's interesting. You know, I think that Eversource is kind of concentrated on the opposition in the North Country and the White Mountains and then in the National Forest, et cetera. And they've sort of focused a little bit less on kind of the central and southern parts of the state. And, you know, here in Concord, I think it would be sort of up on the heights in the eastern part of the city using existing rights of way. But, you know, the towers would go from, you know, typical tower now, I think, is sort of roughly 45 feet or so. They're going to go up to sort of 80 plus feet for this particular project. So it's interesting. I read, you know, the Eversource has started these a series of open houses to kind of explain the revised project. And there was one gentleman at the Concord open house the other day who said, you know, well, you know, why aren't you focused on burying stuff in Concord? And the official said, well, you know, there hasn't been a lot of opposition to that. People have been really focused on the North Country. So it's going to be interesting to see when people in sort of the central and southern parts of the state really think about what the route's going to be, whether there's going to be more pushback. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. Okay.
It's interesting against this whole backdrop. In the northern part and the central part of the state, we have in the southern part of the state with the Kinder Morton Morgan pipeline, gas pipeline, natural gas pipeline, is going to go through a lot of communities in the southern part of the
right,
state.
Right, that's what those folks are
concerned
about.
And they're concerned yeah. about it. And there's very vocal opposition to that. They've been very well organized in opposition. And that, you know, speaking of open houses, Kinder Morgan's been having open houses all over the area. But it's really interesting because the whole point of these two projects, whether you agree with them or not, is that New Hampshire and New England need a more reliable source of energy, you know, more substantial sources of energy, whether it's hydropower from Quebec, whether it's natural gas, and that's really what these issues that what these projects are meant to address.
Yeah.
And you know, I know that's a major concern among, you know, the businesses that we cover and the Business Review. They really are concerned about this, and in terms of economic development for the future of the state. It's something that, you know, that needs to be addressed.
And the big challenge for both Kinder Morgan and for Eversource has been to convince New Hampshireites that there is some benefit for them in terms
yes.
of energy prices, because, the, you know, sort of the conspiracy theory on the pipeline and whether or not this is true or not was that they were just using New Hampshire to get the stuff to Drake it, and then it was going to be sent overseas.
Yes, export,
and then, the,
yeah.
you know, Hydro-Quebec, it's really for Connecticut and southern New Hampshire. And so there's this sort of fear that, you know, we're basically just a conduit to get the power to other parts of the country and the world.
Besides burying a third of the Northern Pass project, one of the big sweeteners was that they promised that 10% of the power produced through the Northern Pass project will go to New Hampshire.
And at very low rates, the lowest rates possible.
Low rates, and, you know, that's one of the sweeteners, and that's apparently was strong enough to get at least some political leaders to say they support the project, or they seem a little less opposed to it. And, you know, it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see what eventually happens with both of these two projects, because the bottom line is the state does need the energy, at least in the short term.
Well, it's interesting. You go up north and you see signs say no to Northern Pass. I was in southern New Hampshire last week and I saw signs everywhere,
absolutely.
No to the pipeline. So.
And then you throw in all the opposition to the various wind projects and you just, it's really a fascinating time to be
really
studying
is.
This stuff.
Yeah.
So, Dean, a quick question for you. There were some discussion over the past week or so about the use of volunteers in New Hampshire state prisons. Now, what's going on? What's the controversy?
The New Hampshire Department of Corrections has a staff shortage in prisons in the state. You know, they actually rely on unpaid volunteers or interns. I'm sure a lot of criminal justice majors over the summer do internships in the prisons, and they do a lot of – they learn kind of the administration and paperwork and internet technology, the IT stuff. They now have a shortage. Those interns have gone back to college. There's no money in the budget to hire staff. They actually – even Governor Hassan had said that they – it is kind of a tradition to rely on some of this unpaid labor to help with the backlog, but the understanding is that it's kind of reaching a crisis now, the backlog of paperwork and IT issues. So they're putting out kind of a desperate plea for anybody who wants to do an internship or some volunteer work. They can actually do it in a way that will actually, if they're concerned, they can have either no or minimal contact with the prison population.
So the controversy is that some people say we shouldn't have volunteers in the state prisons.
Yeah.
This is sensitive. There could be
You should have certified professionals who have experience doing this kind of stuff, not unpaid volunteers. But as I said, you know, Governor Hassan has said, well, that's traditionally how it's been done, and there's just no. And the reality is, there's no money in the corrections budget, Department of Corrections budget, to hire a lot of additional staff.
Yeah, and it makes you realize, you know, an organization that, you know, just relies on interns or volunteers to do some of the work that they should be paying people for, you know, you run the risk of this kind of thing happening.
I want to ask you, Jeff, very quickly, over the past week or so, more than one city hosted a rally saying, you know, New Hampshire hates heroin, basically. Yeah. People coming out publicly saying, I lost a loved one to addiction, or I myself am struggling with addiction. You know, people are getting very public about this and saying, you know, time for action.
Yeah, I've never seen anything like this before in New Hampshire, for sure. You know, there were two rallies held, one in Keene, one in Manchester, and, you know, a lot of people showed up. A lot of people
in Concord, one in Nashua.
Yeah, all over. And a lot of people showed up who had lost loved ones to this, and it's really reaching a point where, you know, you're just not able to ignore it, because unfortunately we've had a heroin problem in the state for years, and it had been ignored, but now really it's reached the point where you're incapable of ignoring this now. We realize we have it, and, you know, anybody who's gone to, you know, AA or something, you gotta, the first step is realizing you have a problem, and, you know, and admitting you have one. And this, I think the state really is at this point right now.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me, Dean, that people are being very public. Before, people were sort of quiet about this, didn't want to say anything. I had somebody come up to me at the food co-op last night and started talking to me about, you know, recovery and addiction, and
they're also talking to the presidential candidates about it, which is really very interesting.
Yeah, and it is getting a tremendous amount of visibility, not only here but around the country, and it's kind of a two-pronged issue. Part of it is kind of heroin, which has become cheap and available, and a lot of people are using that. And the other part of it is prescription opiates and drug abuse. So it's kind of a two-pronged approach, tremendous visibility. The presidential candidates are talking about it. Chris Christie has a TV ad that mentions it. Hillary Clinton has a new multi-million or billion-dollar program that she's announced to deal with this.
Christie's attended some of these rallies, too.
Absolutely. He was at the one in Manchester. They had a rally to raise awareness and for education and resources in Manchester. Kelly Ayotte, Chris Christie were at that one. And then, as we've mentioned, Nashua and Keene also having rallies and kind of commemorating people who have been lost to this. So, I mean, you know, we've been doing this roundup for a number of years now, and it's amazing how many stories we've done on various aspects of this just in the last 6 months or so. Yep.
Right. Well, one more story we need to follow up on, gentlemen, and you are going to have to help me out with this one. Not my strong suit here. The Patriots, just in time for football season, Jeff. A judge rules in the Deflategate case, and it turns out Tom Brady can go back on the field. Untangle this for me, Jeff.
Much to the relief of Patriots fans everywhere, including others on other planets. You know, they've been hoping that they'd have Tom Brady all season, and apparently this federal judge said, you know, the NFL.
A federal judge, wow.
Yes, it went to a judge. And the judge basically said that the NFL and the commissioner, Roger Goodell, just did not follow what an arbitrator would do, some legal thing, and basically said he provided his own kind of industrial justice or something like that. And he really excoriated the NFL for just not following any kind of protocol in suspending Tom Brady. He didn't allow Brady to question witnesses and bring witnesses up.
So it wasn't a good legal process.
It was a very flawed process. And I heard an interview with an attorney who'd already had opposed the NFL on other kind of suspensions, and he said he wasn't surprised because it's always a flawed process with the NFL, which is really interesting because it runs like a well-oiled machine when it comes to getting TV rights and things.
Yeah,
but when it comes to this, they just don't know how to do it.
And this is a big concern for the owners who basically decide whether to hire or fire Commissioner Goodell.
Yes.
Because now the concern is Anytime the NFL rules against a player, the players' union is going to go to court.
Absolutely.
So they see this as kind of a Pandora's box of legal action. You know, so all the owners, other than, of course, Robert Kraft. Are very concerned about this. And the fascinating thing is, in talking to people outside of New England, the judge did not rule on whether or not he thinks Tom Brady was aware
That's
of what was going on.
Right.
He ruled that it was a botched process. So
Absolutely.
So I'm hearing from people outside of New Hampshire saying, well, you know, he probably did it. He just got away with it now. So, but they are appealing.
It really is.
The NFL is appealing.
Yeah, but there's no stay, so he'll be able to play while the appeal.
It is interesting when you go out of New England how there's not many fans of the Patriots, and it reminds me. Speaking as a Yankee fan, it reminds me the Patriots are the Yankees of the NFL because everybody hates the Patriots
Except
outside
New
of New England.
England.
Right. Wow,
it's really interesting.
All right, well, gentlemen, next week on the Exchange, lots of stories, obviously, including midweek. We're going to take a look at the expansion of vaping from going to
Concord, a couple places,
three or four stores in Concord, elsewhere in the state. Vaping seems to be on the rise. Some people say that's progress. Other people say it's a problem. Jeff, what are you going to be tracking next week?
Well, basically, we'll be looking at various things that relating to this export-import bank. It's an issue that's really been under the radar, but it's a concern to a lot of New Hampshire businesses. And we're going to look at what the presidential candidates are doing and maybe what's happening in terms of the congressional delegation.
Oh,
how
okay.
Working on
we'll
it.
Have to talk to you about that because that is really interesting. A lot of people say, Ex-Im Bank, what's that? But you're
exactly.
right. Presidential candidates are talking about
yes.
it. Dean, how about you?
After Labor Day, it's the big presidential kickoff. By my count, there are going to be no fewer than 10 Republican and Democratic candidates here in the next week. And Paul Steinhauser mentioned how Bernie Sanders is winding up in Concord on Labor Day. I'll be interviewing him as part of the Pints and Politics candidate series, Barley House, 5:30 on Monday. It's open to the public here
wow.
in Concord.
Wow. All right. Great. Well, lots to talk about. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Have a good weekend.
You too. Enjoy your Labor Day, everybody.
Thanks, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.